listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, I've got Martin Page.
Hey, Mikey.
And next to him, we got Scott Gershon.
Hi, Mike.
And across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hello, Mike.
And last but not least, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike.
Now who's missing?
No one.
Bobby Summerfield.
Bobby Summerfield is not in the building.
Wow. Got a better offer.
Either that or he's working.
It's the mystery, Mike.
Well, I just want to, you know, welcome everybody to the Audio Nowcast. And last week, we got a rundown of the Grammys by Andrew. And right at the start of the show, he gave us a really good behind the scenes of the Grammys. And there's one thing that really stuck out from the last show was the fact that Andrew missed the red carpet.
It was sad.
It was a little sad.
It is sad, not sad like you're crying, but sad like what the hell's wrong with that guy?
That's right. Well, you know what? Andrew, here at the Audio Nowcast, we took that in consideration, and
what have we here?
Oh,
we actually got you a red carpet.
Oh my God! Now, shall I describe this for the listeners?
If you can, you can describe.
A beautiful red bath mat.
Shag.
It's 21 by 34.
That's right.
Oh, very nice.
Thank you very much.
Debbie
and I will stand on
it.
You won't be able to find it.
But that's for the, you know, so you can have the red carpet experience.
That's fantastic.
So, yes. So, it's from everybody here.
Wow, thank you very much.
How are you? So that means you have to come to at least one more.
That means we have a budget.
That's right. We got a budget for... Anyhow, I just wanted to get that out of the way right now.
That was an emotional moment.
Oh, very sweet.
Yeah.
But today we're going to be talking about a lot of things. Up at the top, I've got a couple different topics that I want to throw out. And on the back half of the show, we're going to talk about money. We're going to talk about continuing the series on making it in music. And it's something that not a lot of people pay attention to, but a lot of people, you know, need to pay attention to. It's money. And so we've got some tips and some advice on the back half. But before that, I wanted to bring up that we got a question from a podcast listener for you, Rob.
Rob's fan club.
Wow.
That's
well,
right.
Well, let's see what the question is.
Do we have a jingle for a question for Rob?
We should. We should. But Dennis Barton wrote in, and he wanted to know.
He sent pictures, too.
At this past NAMM show, you were demoing a VSTi instrument that... you know, did sample playback as well as a lot of different instruments, and he wanted to know what that VSTi was.
Was he at the NAMM show?
Yeah, he was.
Wow. Well, then he wasn't paying attention, was he? Or maybe he came in the middle of the demo.
That's right.
Yeah, maybe it was that.
Or the fact that you only mentioned it one time.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Or he didn't understand a word you were saying.
Yeah. Next time in English. Well, I would assume what he's talking about is there's a plugin from Steinberg called Hypersonic. It's an amazing plugin that lets you basically pick any sound you can think of and search for it and very quickly load it. So it's a great tool when you're writing. And in my demo there, I was calling up sitars and bells and pianos and drums and basses and all kinds of sounds. And it is a plugin that I use in the early stages of writing just because it's so fast and easy.
Is VST audio units?
You know, I'm not sure. I always use the VST version.
And it's it's probably only VST. Yeah. I think all their stuff.
No, they have stuff that's outside of VST, yeah.
Shows what I know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That shows what I know, too. I was there doing demos, and I can't answer that.
But it's not Intel Mac compatible right now, so I wonder if it is audio units or not. Because that's one of the big things about, if you read some of the forums, is... that they haven't released any updates to any of those modules for Intel Mac.
Well, being a PC user for my VST instruments, it's not a problem.
Yeah, like Vista's going to be a real sweet little...
Yeah, when I switch over to it in about 15 years, it's going to be a pain.
Hey, that's, you know, let's bring that up right now. The whole Vista, you know, coming from probably somebody who has more plugins than anybody I know, what is your upgrade plan for Vista? Do you see it even necessary right now?
No. I'm not going anywhere near Vista... for my music systems for a while. I actually already bought Vista to try out on some of my other systems, the ones I use for just business and email and web surfing and that kind of thing. I do want to switch to Vista just because it's pretty. But for the music systems, it would be such a nightmare, and it would take so long to just functionally get back to where I am right now that it's just, it's not something I'm going to be doing anytime soon. I really don't think I'll do it within a year, probably more.
Are you the only, who, anybody else work?
Okay,
PC?
February 27th, 2007, so we can just stamp that, you know?
Do you have PC in your studio?
Yeah,
studio?
But, you know, it's, we're, even in the video game side, whether we're using dev kits, at the moment, we're not going into Vista yet.
How about you, Andrew, PC, Mac?
There's a PC in there, but yeah, it's not going to Vista anytime soon. No way.
How about you, Martin?
No, I don't even know what you're talking about. I thought you were talking about holidays or something. Vista. I've seen advertisements for it, but I'm quite content on what I'm working on. I don't need to move forward. And I always rely on you anyway to tell me if I should.
That's what I wanted to give that question to you. During the headlights look.
At the moment, I heard that Vista has some problems on the audio, sound card, audio in general at the moment.
Yeah, it looks cool. I mean, but I'm still on.
Well, that's why I got it. I want to have the one machine that can have all the cool, floaty, transparent windows and all that other stuff, and then I'll get it on my system, and then I can, you know, just
or you could just turn back to XP. Look at your Mac.
That's right. Or look at your Mac.
I could do that too.
Have you seen the commercial?
For what?
The Mac PC commercial.
Not familiar, no.
You're wearing the glasses. I guess.
That's right. He's the PC.
He's the PC.
Yeah, I am.
The Mac guys are over here.
I am.
All right, well, Dennis, I hope somewhere in there was an answer to your question.
I hope so.
What else? Just a rundown. You did Hypersonic, and what other modules did you demo at the show?
I was actually, each demo was a little bit different because I was just stepping through all the plugins they had on that system. It was a freeform demo, so each demo I did, I would just call up whatever kind of grabbed my imagination at that point. And I did a lot of Groove Agent too. Because that had some pretty good drum sounds, and I played virtual guitarist and virtual bassist, the Grand, you know, a lot of the Steinberg plugins, which are plugins that I use when I'm writing.
Right,
virtual old NAMM demo guy.
Well, hey, whatever it takes. But I do use those tools when I'm getting an initial idea for writing, and then I generally expand to Giga Studios and other machines, you know, to fill out the sounds. But when you're just trying to get an idea down, you don't want to be searching for sounds and lose that creative moment, you know. So if I happen to hear an idea for a song that needs to be sitar, it's nice to know there's one right there that I can load real quick.
Right. Now and a lot of the sounds are really usable, too.
Yeah, really good. Really good. And with the virtual guitarist and virtual bassist, a lot of times I'll come up with an idea using those and then replace it with a real player. Or in the case of virtual guitarist, sometimes I'll just have a real player play on top of the virtual guitarist track. You know, so you get a real recording and a sort of a canned recording, but when you put them together, it sounds pretty good.
How do you catalog all your sounds? I mean, you've got hundreds of thousands of sounds. I mean, what do you use to catalog them so you're not, like, for instance, myself, I have no catalog, so even though I've got thousands of songs, I
can't find any of them.
It's like, I go to the same, like, five bass drums because I like those bass drums, but every once in a while, I'll start digging a little deeper, you know, and I know they have new things like Core with their library functions.
Well, and actually, Cubase now, Cubase 4 has a library function built in. It has a very sophisticated database where you can search for sounds and presets for your VST effects and it can search across your network. It's a really cool database system that's built into it now. So that's really useful. But for many years, what I've done is I have a database that I build on Microsoft Access. And if I'm going through a synth and I hear a sound that's really cool, even if it's not for the project I'm working on then, I'll just say, oh, that's a cool string pad or whatever. I'll go into Access and just put it in there.
Wow.
By category.
You manually load the sound?
Yeah, you're manually loading all your sounds?
No, it's not loading the sounds. It's just loading.
No, I know.
It's basically reminders.
Right, the reminders. But still, that's like an awful lot of reminders.
Well, I just put the really special stuff in
there.
I got
you.
A lot of the synths I'm using now, like the Virus TI and some of these other synths that work as plugins, it's much easier to organize the sounds by category. But I think it's going to eventually go the way of Core and the database built into Cubase, because they're both pretty powerful. I still have issues with them, though. In some ways, they're fast because you can search for sound really quickly.
Right.
But then if you want to hear it, it has to actually turn on that plugin and load that instrument. And unless you're careful, you find yourself waiting for all these different instruments to load. And it takes a while to get used to it so you can move through it quickly.
Well, Scott, do you use like SoundMine or anything over at your place?
Yeah. We've had a lot of different librarians, and we're actually working with SoundMiner to come up with a whole new version. And it's pretty amazing because it works over the network, works on PC. Yeah. Control parameters where not anyone can just download your library. And it's actually really cool. I think it should be coming out probably within the next 6 months.
Wow. That's cool. Andrew, do you have a lot of sounds in your library that you organize any special way?
No, I don't organize them any way at all, actually. I've used the, because I'm almost exclusively running Pro Tools now, right. So I use that. Their browser has a search function built in, and
which
I save custom libraries within that, but not even that much. I kind of just know where my stuff is. And so I'm sure I've got big chunks that I have no idea what it is. But all the chunks I do know, I just remember, and I kind of know where to start looking for things.
I'm guilty of that, too. Even with all the databasing I've done, most of the time if I'm on a project, I'll just go back to what I can remember as being the cool stuff. And
I don't know. Well, a lot of times I like to just kind of just go through whatever synth plugin and just find a sound, because I find a lot of times the sound will motivate the emotion, which motivates the mood if you're writing. I mean, Martin, you work like that a lot, don't you?
Oh yeah, I'm very much like Andrew. You know, I don't really think too much past what picking up a guitar or knowing maybe six or different pad sounds that I like to work for more piano sounds, because I'm purely trying to just write. But like you as well, Mike, I sometimes experiment and find a sound, and that sound will lead me into another arena. I'm a little bit nervous of using the same things all the time, because you can get bland. But at the same time, for me particularly, I want to get quickly to a place where I know where I can, relate from and move quite fast with. So keeping big libraries can be more confusing for someone like me. I try to keep everything quite small and then expand after the idea comes.
That, the fact that you play a lot of your instruments too, though. You play the guitar and you play the bass, so it's not like you have to look for it.
No, like you say, sometimes a color will and also I find it quite exciting because I don't really know too much about what I'm looking for. So it's fun to go in with a new instrument and suddenly start learning it, and that is fun. If I know too much, it's not much fun. I like to leave it a little bit mysterious.
But then you also run the risk of, if you have big libraries, you run the risk of getting into production before you actually write the song.
Yeah.
So you actually want to create the content and then produce it, rather than produce it and then find out there's really no content.
There's something, actually, what you're saying there is, for me personally, it's something really good to hear something quite raw and undone.
Yeah.
And then, walk away from it and then come back and go, I can see now this could do with some production, or, it's good I didn't do too much to it. It's speaking great with not, going too fast. So I try to discipline myself to keep pretty simple at the beginning.
I think it's really good advice to keep the palette limited in the beginning. And that's basically what I've been talking about in the Steinberg demos. In the beginning of any writing, I'm basically just loading a few plugins, giving myself that sound palette, and pretending I don't have any other gear or plugins. Just keep it real simple.
Simple to the palette of, how many sounds it has? Like 6,000?
No, 1,000. A little over 1,000. But they're categorized.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel daunting. It's not like you're staring at the face of a million sounds.
All right. Well, that was a good answer.
Cool.
Coming for full circle. I wanted to bring something up with you guys, and just if anybody's heard anything about this, but apparently I've been, I don't know if you guys, surf a lot of the really cool sites like Create Digital Music, for your, kind of behind the scenes tech stuff in the music industry, but, there's this big rumor that there's not going to be like a Logic 8. Because apparently Apple's been working on some Pro Tools killer for the last 5 years. And I read that again today on Create Digital Music, and I just wanted to know if anybody's heard anything about that, anybody's heard any of the rumors out that. Do you think it's going to happen? Do you think it can happen?
The Pro Tools killer.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, that's,
Feel free to speculate, because this is
that
just...
That won't happen. I mean, Pro Tools killer is just ridiculous. They might come out with something amazing.
Right.
And in 5 or 6 years, it may turn out that they are now the standard for recording. But, I mean, Pro Tools, that's just ridiculous. Well, everything used to be, oh, it's the Synclavier killer. You know, it's going to be the Synclavier killer.
But it was. That was Pro Tools.
No, but they killed themselves before Pro Tools was actually ready to kill them.
Sure.
And it was only, Pro Tools was there to step into the breach, which was great.
Well, I mean, if you look at logically, they have the technology to create a sonic solution similar to what Final Cut did against the Avid.
Right.
And sell it for $1,000 rather than selling it for thousands and thousands. And I think that they need an audio solution to support Final Cut. They don't really have it.
Right.
They've got Soundtrack Pro.
Which is not it.
Well, Soundtrack Pro for dialogue, only for simplistic dialogue, is actually cool because it's a program that comes with a lot of tools very specifically made for dialogue, and that's it. What I thought was interesting with it is the plugins were high quality and it was very focused. Most companies, even like DigiDesign, wants to be a lot of things to a lot of people. Soundtrack Pro came out to be something very specific for specific need. Do they have the possibilities and technology? Sure. The question is, do they want to?
I think they do. I think they, I'm with you. The fact that what Final Cut Pro did for, you know, to the Avid, and there's a lot of Final Cut Pro studios out there now, they can easily do the same thing with audio if they do two things. Number one, if it's under $1,000 and you can do time code. I think one of the worst things about Pro Tools is, then the LE systems, you know, you have to buy a $1,200 upgrade in order to get timecode.
But so, you don't think Digi would rectify that problem?
Oh, you know
in
what?
A second.
You know what? I absolutely hope they rectify that in a second. I hope there's a, the problem with Soundtrack Pro is it's not mixer friendly. It's really hard to mix in that in Soundtrack.
Yeah, it's not a
right, but if they come out with a multi-track, you know, hard disk recorder that has timecode, that can take AAFs, OMFs, and can do, you know, it doesn't even have to do, you know, RTAS plugins. If it just does audio units plugins and VSTIs, that could be a really serious, you know, Pro Tools.
It could, but I think also, though, you've got to be careful when you say, oh, what Final Cut Pro did to the Avid, because if you talk to any serious film editor, they will not work on Final Cut Pro unless they are forced to because of budget. They still would rather have the Avid. The Avid is still the professional system, with Final Cut Pro doing very well and filling the gap where I think in the audio world Pro Tools LE lives, though. DigiDesign already has a product that's below its own top of the line. I've never spoken to a film editor who does features who would rather work in Final Cut than an Avid.
But what I found actually, though, is that it's that the director now has Final Cut Pro. The picture cutter, instead of having to rent a full-blown $100,000 system, has his laptop with Final Cut Pro on it. So what's happened is similar to what's happened in our world where mixers were $1 million. You want to get an SSL 9000 and you get the Neve consoles. Now all of a sudden people have a 192 fader console for $30,000. You know, and all of a sudden they don't need the Mitsubishi digital machine or the Sony digital machine and the console and all this. All of a sudden for 30,000, 60,000 tops without the icon, all of a sudden they have that same capability and it totally destroyed the mixing market other than for a few people that want to stay in the analog world. So now what's happened, I think Digi could.
Yeah, but don't you think it's different to talk about a paradigm shift, you know, going to computer-based editing and mixing as opposed to actual hardware mixing. But we're talking about just somebody bringing out a competitive product that's exactly the same, which, I mean, that's where I think it's different. You're talking about just another audio editing and mixing app as opposed to
it's another
a
audio,
new way to do it.
But it's another audio app that's going to be one-tenth the price.
Yeah.
Do we know that for the...
Well, no, it's all
speculation. That's the thing.
It's all,
I mean,
speculation.
It is all rumors.
But,
I mean,
and that's what we're doing right now is we're just speculating.
But if it's going to be, unless it's going to be hardware-based the way Pro Tools HD is, then we have to compare it to Pro Tools LE. And, all right, they might kick Pro Tools LE's butt, but you're kicking the butt of a $400 system.
But, you know what, what an upgrade, though. Let's say it comes out and it's under $1,000, and what if you could take your Pro Tools LE and then just buy the converters and turn that into a Pro Tools HD? I mean, that's the thing about DigiDesign is the step between LE and HD is such a huge step.
Yeah. But also, it depends on what industry you're looking at, because I think that Apple has the audio solution through Logic. I mean, whether people like it or not, but there is a music solution in that realm. But one of the things that I think is important is post-production.
Yeah.
Because to cut dialogue, which is maybe 8 to 16 tracks maximum, you don't need the plugins, you don't need to go to 192, you're still spending $30,000, you still need the 192, you still need the cards. It's ridiculous what you're paying for. And you got to remember, a lot of post-production houses, you know, they have 100 Pro Tools systems, mm-hmm. 50. So every time they need an upgrade, a plug-in or something like this, it's huge expense. And I think with the clients, and you look at TV and film wanting to spend less, it's becoming a vice grip for the companies that the gear is costing more, the clients want to pay less.
Right.
So something's got to give. They got to pay more, or the gear's got to come down. And I think that whoever, whether it's Apple or not, in certain instances, I'm not talking about full-blown design systems and capabilities with the latest plugins, but I'm talking about Foley editing, ADR editing, dialogue editing, things in that ilk. If somebody could come up with a solution.
Well, you know, even spot mixing and mixing for television and documentaries, yeah, and anything but feature films, you know, are easily in the market for that.
All right. But let's take that set of things you want to get done. How much would Pro Tools LE have to expand to be able to do in Pro Tools LE?
You know what? Nothing. You can do all that in Pro Tools LE right now. You can mix everything that I just said, because I've done.
Still track out of it.
Well, right, but so if they, but let's say that Digi said, and I'm, you know, I have no inside information. I'm making this up off the top of my head. If they just said, you know what, the track count's stupid, do whatever your computer could do.
Right.
Is that it? At this point, then there's nothing to kill?
No,
but it's going to be.
And time code. Time code's a huge, huge issue because it'll allow you to do all your spot editing.
Okay, so Pro Tools LE is, so under $1,000 for the Apple thing, let's say, and do you get any I.O. with that, or that's just the software?
You know what? Right now, the buzz is just on the software.
Okay, so it's $1,000 just for software.
Yeah.
So Pro Tools LE, you get some hardware because they make you buy some hardware.
Well,
but
you know what? I take that back too. They also are saying that there could be a hardware solution too, since apparently Final Cut Extreme is going to.
But not for $1,000.
No, but not for $1,000.
Okay, so if you spend $1,000 on Pro Tools LE, including their newly reduced price post production toolkit because Apple's come out with this thing,
I think it'll actually help Digi, because Digi, when they're the only game in town, can do whatever they want.
Yeah, and they make a lot of the same mistakes that Sinclair made
exactly.
And Fairlight made when they thought they were the only game in town,
weren't. We thought Nuendo was going to give them a run for their money, and really, but the problem is Nuendo hasn't. And it would be good, because what will happen is Digi will only get better if they've got a competitor out there that they've got to make sure.
It's true.
Based on you know.
But I think also then they have to. There has to be the high-end system that you step up to.
I don't think Apple wants to go for that. I mean,
well, but then they will not take all of the people who edit on LE so that they can send it over to HD.
But one thing that Apple will probably do is have partners. Meanwhile, DigiDesign excludes everybody and makes sure that, you know, you got to pay homage to them. Meanwhile, Apple would go to Yamahas and Rolands and anybody else and say, you want to build a mixer for it, you want to do this, you want to do that, and let the industry support the audio operating system, if you want to call it, and let them grow it in such, rather than DigiDesign owning everything.
Is there any history to pull from, though, to say that's what they do?
Well, they want to hit mass market. I mean, if you look at...
But has Apple ever done that before with a software product?
Logic.
Final Cut, you know, definitely they went to Final Cut Express, and then you see their you know,
but it's not like there were a lot of people.
They're like a couple companies that make hardware controllers.
Well, they'll,
right?
They'll partner up with hardware companies to work with.
Yeah, but and Digi had the Huey spec. I think there's a little like built-in Digi bashing because they've been sort of at the top for a while, and I see it and I get it and I don't have a problem with it. But I think if you start listing the actual systems and what we're talking about that they're going to kill, for under a grand, if you spend $1,000 on Pro Tools, you get a lot of LE. And the only thing that I think they're being stupid about is the track count.
Yeah.
And that's a software switch.
But also I think that, you know, one thing that Digi doesn't do right now is they're not network savvy. In other words, you have one system, one editing. But if you have a giant server system and everyone's like editing dialogue off the server rather than editing off an individual system where all of, I mean, I saw something which was amazing on Nuendo, which was an echoing system. So somebody's editing on the network and it automatically echoes to a second system. And as someone's editing, all your tracks start appearing on the stage system. And I'm sitting there going, this is great.
Well, and two or three times, Digi's been poised to do that, because the first time was when they bought Rocket Networks, which was the ideal situation. For some reason, that didn't work. And then when Avid bought them, Avid has their entire Unity server thing, which does that for the video editing. So somewhere in the bowels, they've got to be working on
it. It's going to get close, because I remember when Rocket Network came out, that whole idea of working on the same project and then uploading it into the same session that somebody was on.
And just having it show up as they were.
Exactly.
But it was show up. I kind of feel like I'm Digi-bashing here. But it, sorry, Digi.
It's all right.
But, you know, but it is something, it feels that Digi only will do what it needs to do when it needs to do it to keep itself not ahead of the pack, but with the pack.
Right.
So, like, Nuendo will do it,
but they are the pack. You can't be ahead of yourself, even close right
now.
One
of the things I've heard at NAMM, I spoke to a lot of companies and no specific names, that a lot of people went, ugh, but I got to deal with DigiDesign. It's like, hey, can you take your hardware and make it into a plugin? Can you do this? Can you do this? Yeah, but Digi won't allow us to do this, and Digi won't allow us to do that. So what's happening is they've got everybody kind of by the balls. And you got to play with them the way they want to be played.
Can we say by the balls?
You got to play with them. Right?
You know,
I didn't say it, mate. I'm just following up.
All right, well, you know, on that note, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
It'll be very interesting.
And the whole, you know, these rumors.
And I don't
want
to be a Digi apologist about the stuff either. But I think it's conceptually these are all very good points. Right. But in the reality of what's available and what has been available for 5 or 6 years,
if Digi Digi's doing a lot of stuff because they have the perception that Apple's going to do it. I mean, Apple has unlimited funds in comparison to Digi.
But as
long as it keeps Digi on their toes, that'll make me and my Pro Tool system
better.
Yeah,
but I think you'd have to think that a company as big and in the position that Digi's in is at least trying to be on their toes anyway.
Digi's trying to be everything to everybody. I mean, they're trying to be the music system. They're trying to be the music mixing system. They're trying to be the post-production music mixing system.
And are they failing miserably at any of these?
No, but you know what? They're being adequate. And they're not really in post-production. It's okay. It's getting there. But
let me point out one other thing. If we're going to go back to that concept of Pro Tools killer, Nuendo was poised feature-wise to be a Pro Tools killer. It could have been. It comes down to a lot more than just a feature set.
But they kept being bought and sold.
It comes down to how it's marketed. I mean, you have to have people adopt the technology. You have to get, you know, entire cities of engineers to kind of sign on to use this thing so that they can trade projects back and forth. It's a lot more than just a clever software design. And I don't know, Apple doesn't have any track record so far of killing any kind of high-end product.
They couldn't even kill Microsoft Office, you know, and they tried. Boy, did they try.
Yeah, but they took
some business from Avid with Final Cut. No question about that. But it wasn't an Avid killer.
Well, I'll tell you what. Apparently, the Pro Tools killer is supposed to be able to work on your iPhone so that you can download sessions up and down from your iPhone.
Fantastic.
Just kidding, but that's a good way to segue out.
So what do we hear about Microsoft buying Apple?
Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to take a break after that heated discussion, and which was good. It was a good discussion, and hopefully I hope the competition keeps both companies on the
During the break, we're going to go scrap in the parking lot.
Yeah, right. I got some Pro Tools gear I need to sell really fast, apparently. Yeah.
So we'll catch you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast, and Scott and Andrew are still outside beating each other to a pulp. That was pretty funny. Hey, really quick, before we get into the business side of things that we're going to talk about, Scott, I understand that you went out and recorded some llamas.
I did.
Just tell us a little bit really quick on how that went, because just to let people know, Steve Jay, who's the bass player for Weird Al, was on the podcast. I believe it was podcast number 21. So if you want to listen to that one, and they have a ranch with a bunch of llamas, from what I understand.
No, it's great. Yeah, we went out and had our way with the llamas. And
this is a very strange podcast.
Very strange.
I'm moving away now.
Yeah, it was. Miles actually recorded. The llamas were going through a domination matrix kind of situation, and one of them was just screaming at the other one. So he recorded that and gave it to us, and we went out there and we're just trying to piss off some llamas.
Piss off some llamas.
And they're not. Actually, they're quite big and
what kind of noises do they make? Oh, that's good.
And they're, and all of a sudden they look at the microphone and they go, and this green stuff just comes out.
That's
and just,
beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful. Lovely stuff.
Lovely. So,
it was podcast 20. I just looked it up. It was 21.
Oh, and Steve was basically jumping on the backs of the llamas. And it was
man, this is really getting into some heavy
stuff.
Oh, yeah,
it's great
here,
some stuff. Yeah. But, it was wonderful stuff. You know, through manipulating, we recorded it at 192 and 24-bit and had two recorders out there and...
you had your way with llamas.
And we had our way with llamas.
What were your, really quick, what was the mics and the decks that you were using?
We were using two Sound Devices 744Ts, and I believe I was using a 191 Neumann, and I believe...
Do you use a boom mic or a lamalier?
A lamalier. Uh-huh. You were just waiting.
Is that what you were...
That's all I got. I've been sitting here for 5 minutes. That's all I got.
Oh, man. I think Peter Zinda was using a 416 and a Sheps combo.
Yeah, it's a different Sheps.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
tell people why you go out there and do that, because you'll never know when you want to use the.
it's a finish.
Come here, Daisy.
Daisy.
Anytime we get access to animals, you gotta go for it. Tomorrow we're doing something even stranger.
With some more animals.
Was there
one named Dolly?
Dolly.
Dolly Lama.
We're actually on Thursday. We're going out to Griffith Park with about 12 people, and we're going to do Walla Group sessions outside in reaction to giant transformers plunging their way through the city. So we're going to get people to be running. And we're putting the mics about 20 feet up and having the perspective of looking down and having people just running amok.
Wow.
For 4 hours and hopefully not get arrested.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool.
Well, you didn't get arrested with the llamas, did you?
No, so, yeah. We were out in the boonies.
Now, do you need a permit for that?
What?
I'm just curious.
Theoretically, for sound, if we had picture, we would. But for sound, it's still the best.
You just
child.
Go make noise
we
and
go
record
do it
and
until we get kicked out. You know, we did a Michael Jackson one, a history video years and years ago, and we had to do Esperanto, and we were yelling because Michael was coming and these guards, and we did a park in Beverly Hills, and we did that for about 3 hours, and then all the police came because they weren't really sure what was going on, and here they were, about 16 people just running around, screaming at the top of their lungs. But we do have people just to make sure that people don't think a terrorist situation is occurring or something really bad is happening. We have people standing by to calm everybody.
I feel sorry for those people in Beverly Hills that were waiting for Michael Jackson.
There is a funny story because we record guns all the time. And we did one situation where we were out in Fraser Park, which is a great place to record, and we were using full automatic and just a full day of guns. And this poor park ranger who did not really know what was going on crested a hill with his car as far as away as he can be. And we had all these, you know, teams doing shootings. And he's on his PA, you know, who are you? What are you? And I can see this guy going, I hate my job. Because here he is going, and this guy's shooting, you know, AK-47s and just everything. And, you know, he was really as far back as he really could be, you know.
And then he's yelling, can I stop
like,
that? Stop
excuse
that
me, right now. Let go of the llama.
Well, that sounded like that was a really great adventure for you there on the llamas.
Oh, yeah, you know.
All right, guys. But we're going to
changed man.
Oh yes.
Okay, we're going to segue into speaking a little bit about business right now. Kind of continuing what we've been talking about these last couple of weeks, starting with Rich and with Summer, the last podcast. So I think we should talk about right now one thing that's going to affect everybody, and that's money. And you know, everybody has your horror stories about money, whether it's been mismanaged or whether you haven't been able to collect. In my case, I worked for a company where they used to pay me in cash, and they wouldn't pay me everything they owed me because they were going out of business. And I'd come up to them at the, you know, every pay period, and the guy would say, okay, how much do you really need to get paid? And if you owed me $1,000, he'd maybe pay me $400 or maybe, you know, $600. So I was just wanting to bring to the table, guys, how can you protect yourself, first of all, in situations where you're doing some work and you basically want to make sure you get paid? I mean, I know what I do now, but does anybody have any advice for anybody or any horror stories of your own about getting paid or not getting paid for any work that they've done?
I think, Mike, you know, in that, for me personally as a songwriter or you know, producing some acts, is that you try up front to be working with people that you can trust. And I mean, you it's great if you can find, you know, somebody to represent you, a manager or somebody that can, you know, do preliminary talks for about what you're about to do. I always felt like I would want to work with people that I felt strong about. That was one of the keys to me, you know.
That's great advice.
That I could trust, you know.
Right off the bat is to find people that, you know, work with people that have a really good reputation.
Yeah, reputation, and also, you know, you might know their track record, you might know their history. For me personally, I was working with labels, and I knew some of the bands and other people that had worked with them before. And I had, as a songwriter, I had a manager who could, you know, do the conversations that I didn't want to do, you know, because as an artist, sometimes you don't want to be having those kinds of conversations with somebody you're going to co-write with or produce. So it was quite important for me to have somebody represent me before I did stuff, somebody I could trust. And of course, just as we said there, you know, individuals have to be quite careful about who they work with. So you have to, you know, make sure that your partnership is seems healthy.
You know? Well, you know, that brings up a good point as to why you want an agent, you know, right off the bat, if that's going to help you with your negotiations, especially when you have to work with people.
Yeah, collaborations, you know, I'm sure we've all felt like, you know, around the table here that you don't really want to be, if somebody you're going to work with, you don't want to be talking about percentages. You know,
well,
you can't be creative if you're just talking
about money or worrying about money.
One thing that I wanted to, you know, stress with people is even when you're starting out, even if you're just doing small gigs or selling a small amount of CDs online or CD Baby or something like that, you need to set yourself up at the very beginning on how you're going to handle your money. You need to have a plan. You can't just all of a sudden hope to solve the problems as they come along, especially when it comes to your finances. Does anybody have any really good suggestions on, you know, at what point they started or stories about what point they started to, like, really kind of have to get control over their money and over their finances? Like, was it your first gig? Was it the first big royalty check? I mean, when did that come into play for some of you guys? You know, the business aspects.
The first sessions I did, I got paid with llamas. And I was quite happy for that. Yeah.
You know, I think that, you know, it's I work in an industry that has no residuals in post-production, so whatever I'm going to make, I've got to make on a weekly or a project situation. And I make good money, but it's not enough money to retire off of, or there's no money that's going to be coming in when I'm not actually doing something. So I think that when you get to the point where you make a little bit of money, I think you need to invest it. I mean, you need to be smart enough, you need to educate yourself. Once you get to a certain point within your artistry, I think it behooves those artists to understand how to invest money, where to invest money, and even if it's finding a high interest account. You know, not just having money sitting there and not making money for you, because eventually it accumulates, it compounds. I don't want to talk about accounting, but it does, you know.
It's a good point, though. Also, I was very aware that when you start off, you're not going to do, it's going to be, it might be slow. And so everything you made, you sort of put to one side, knowing there are going to be some quiet moments, you know, particularly as a writer, you're waiting for your royalties to come around and not really sure how successful a song's going to be. So I was always aware that there were going to be dips. And so whenever you did make some money, I tended to put it to one side, however small it was, because I... As a writer, you knew your royalties were going to come, you know, down the line.
Well, I found also one of the really good things about working with in music and in entertainment is just the fact that you can use this system to work for you too. I mean, with tax write-offs of your gear and things of that nature.
Everything entertainment related, whether it's buying a video game, a record, a CD, anything, yeah, it's all a write-off.
Research. Yes.
And then the problem is, then you get to make a decent amount of money, and there's something called AMT that hits you. And it all goes away. No, I'm sorry. But
explain what AMT is.
Alternative minimum tax. It means that, you know, it's interesting. I kind of feel like an accountant now.
That's okay.
Alternative minimum tax was made for what, like 70 people or something silly like that, that at that time was considered just well off. And now there's tens of millions of people in the U.S. now that are getting hit with it every single year. And it's growing exponentially because the cost of living's gone up. But the AMT is never taken into account for inflation. So something that – it basically meant that when you were really rich, you had to pay. You know, there was no way around it. And all these write-offs that you had, including children and all these normal things you would write off, goes away. It all goes away. So, you know, and right now, a majority of everybody in California is getting hit by it. You know, dual-income families, it's not that high.
Wow.
I think anything like a little bit over 100,000, you start hitting AMT. Because 100,000 at the time was considered, oh my God, you're rich now. You're, you know, it's out of control.
That's when you start that dummy corporation in the Bahamas.
But you know, one thing you were saying as far as starting off, I think that in my experiences within the recording studio as an engineer or as a post-production guy, you're going to, you know, when you start off, you work at some kind of really schlazes, actually. And I think, you know, some people hate it. I think there's a deal that happens. You don't know what you're doing, and they're not going to pay you for it either. So you go there and you start to learn a craft. You start getting good, you leave. Because you're being treated probably not very well, and you're probably getting paid crap. But they've taught you, you've given them some labor. Then you move on. It's not a place that you stay for 10 years. It's a place you stay for maybe a year, two.
No, that's true.
A couple months, and then get out to a better place.
You're absolutely right, because I did learn a lot in that job, even though they screwed me royally at the end. But and it was time to go, and I was there for, you know, about a year and a half. Go ahead.
You know, and the most important thing I think that's come out of it for me, because I've worked in the sweatshops a little bit, was, and some of them were very well known, a lot of people work there because they churn and burn people.
Right.
But what happens is you'll be 10 years down the line, you'll be somewhat a professional, you'll meet a guy and say, how'd you get started? Oh, I worked for so-and-so. So did I. Oh, my God, we have something in common. Now all of a sudden you're talking, it gets moving. Hey, I'd love to help you. And it's a way of bonding and connecting. And it almost becomes a fraternity of people that, you know, went through this
hell
screwed together. Yeah, yeah.
People that got screwed for the same guy, so you're all...
Yeah, yeah.
I have another kind of angle on this, too, is a lot of times if you have a studio or you have any kind of production facility or you're a talented musician or whatever, you'll run into people as your career develops who want you to do things as a favor. And they'll say, you know, do me this favor this time, and then later when we have a real budget, we'll call you back and, you know, we're going to bring you in. And it's kind of a double-edged sword. A lot of times, if you're willing to do these cheap favors, then when the client eventually has a big budget, they think of you as the guy who's willing to work for cheap. So they're not going to call you when they have real money.
Right.
The trick is, if you feel like you want to do a job for someone for cheap to try to win your way in with them, just know that you need to get as much out of that relationship in the beginning as possible. In other words, use it as a learning experience for yourself, too. Because you may never hear from them again And I'm not saying you shouldn't invest the time and do kind of spec projects to see where it might lead, but there's a definite real phenomenon that if you're willing to work for cheap, you become thought of as the guy who's willing to work for cheap. And it doesn't always translate into high-paying jobs. Usually it doesn't.
No, that's a really good point. That leads me to the next thing about, don't be afraid to price yourself at your worth. You know, you see a lot of people going out there that are just, cutting these deals where they're like, I'll work in your studio for, $500 for 2 weeks. And
you do have to start someplace. And obviously sometimes you have to do those things to just get a foot in the door. But most of the time, the people who are asking you to work cheap, they understand that they're getting a huge value and they understand that they're undervaluing you. And they know what they're doing. They're taking advantage. And the trick is, in your early days of a career, understand that they think they're taking advantage of you. You need to be taking advantage of the situation, too, which is learn as much as possible and go into it with your eyes open.
No, that's true, because I definitely learned a lot at that one place, and I would not be mixing what I'm mixing now if I hadn't learned. And
just think about it. All of us here at the podcast, the money that you pay us tempted us in.
That's right.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know what I mean? He paid good. Yeah,
but, you had to talk to my agent.
No, I'm just doing this because he said when he gets a TV show, he's going to call us all in for
that.
I was just doing it for the carpet.
Yeah. And you just got it.
Yeah.
Mike just told me to introduce me to a llama sometimes.
and he did.
And he did.
So we're done.
And you're in love.
Well, wow. That, note to self, don't bring up llamas in podcast anymore. Or else you get jokes that start with Dolly. But, I just wanted to talk a little bit about that and really encourage people out there as they're, starting, whether they're going to make money with their music or they're going to make money in their career in music. You really got to go into it with your eyes open, and you really have to line up all your P's and Q's, especially on your finances, because, you don't want to be caught with, a $10,000 tax bill because you forgot to declare a bunch of income and stuff. Just do it the right way, and in the long run, you're just going to be better off.
Also, the rules have changed, and they've tightened the way people used to always write off rooms in their house for business. Like if you have a studio set up in your house, it's a really good idea to check with a good accountant before you start writing anything off, or even before you buy stuff, to know what you can write off.
Right.
I got audited once years ago. I had a studio in my living room at a house, and I got audited for 2 years in a row, actually. I think it was for 93 and 94. I got audited within a month for both of those years, and I had to go down, and I brought pictures of the studio, which was in the living room. And I had taken these pictures with a fisheye lens to show all the equipment in the living room at the time. And in the corner of one of the pictures was a coffee maker. And I was sitting there with the auditor, and she looked at the picture and she said, "Well, I see a lot of equipment, but I see a coffee maker in the corner. Do you mean to tell me in this room you never have a personal cup of coffee?" And I said, "Well, I guess I've had a personal cup of coffee." She said, "Well, then we can't write off any of this room." So at that moment, she just immediately disallowed the entire studio, because there was a coffee maker in the corner that I might have had a personal cup of coffee from.
So don't have coffee makers.
Well, that's definitely part of it.
If it's not in a separate structure, it has got to be where there is nothing in that room that can be used for anything but work. It can't have an office, even, unless your business is the office. It can't be the office for your studio, because they'll say, "Well, yeah, but you're doing your personal taxes there too."
Yeah.
And then it's all over.
And it was a hard fight to appeal that.
What if you have a photo of a llama or something on the wall?
Well, that's work.
Yeah. Not fun work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, hey, it's been nice having you guys here today on the Audio Nowcast.
And visit us all in jail.
And we're going to have to pick up this topic.
This podcast is rated R.
When we don't have llamas on the mind.
Can we do sheep next week?
Is this the announcement?
Yeah. Yes, I'm buying a sheep.
Speaking of studios, one other thing I want to, you know, I'm totally.
Where are we?
Where are we? We're talking about a shape, man.
Speaking of studios, there's a big edit right there. Speaking of studios, I wanted to talk, Rob, before we run out of time, a little bit about the addition to your studio that the kind of the odyssey that you're going through right now. If you want to kind of tell everybody what you've recently got installed.
Yeah, it's definitely been an odyssey. I've been going back and forth for a really long time, for months, about wanting to change the console in my room. I've actually had two O2Rs in the front of my studio for years, mostly because I had furniture inertia. I had them built into a beautiful workstation desk. It was a beautiful custom-made desk that I had built, I don't know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, something like that.
Long time ago.
And so I've actually been mixing in Pro Tools for quite a while, but I had the O2Rs sitting in the front of the room because they looked nice in the furniture, and I finally decided it was time to change that. So I looked into a bunch of different consoles and control surfaces and all kinds of other things, and I settled on... Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Apple's new.
I settled on a D-Control, which is one of the Icon consoles from DigiDesign.
The big one.
The big one. And
the big Icon.
The big Icon. Dun, dun, dun. And
how
it got
many faders?
48 faders.
48.
It's a behemoth.
Virtual faders.
It's a behemoth. They don't feel virtual when you're sitting there in front of it. This thing is huge. And it really feels like sitting in front of a big console again, and we're still mixing in Pro Tools. You know, the joke is that this thing is just a giant mouse.
Right.
But anybody who says that just hasn't seen that it has a keyboard, too. No, it's easy to look at it as a giant mouse until you actually sit and mix on it, and then you realize it's, you know, leagues beyond what you could ever do with a mouse. And I was happy working mixing with a mouse for years. That was never a problem, but... When you actually use one of these large format control surfaces, you realize it's just a totally different animal.
What's the best thing about the Icon? Right off the bat, what would you say the best thing that...
Other than it's big.
Other than it's big? Well, I'm not really great at using it yet. I will say, with my limited knowledge, I've only had it for 2 days, with my limited knowledge of it so far, the surround panner that's built in, you know, there's a touch screen where you can pan things around the room and joysticks... that has already made the film mix that I'm in the middle of go much, much faster since I got it.
Are they motorized? The joysticks motorized?
No, apparently Harrison owns a patent on that.
So they're not motorized?
They're not motorized, but they are touch sensitive, and there's next to the joysticks are a touch screen where you can grab these little position indicators and move things around the room just with your finger on a touch screen.
Yeah.
And that actually, in some ways, is more responsive than a motorized joystick because you can tap anywhere on the screen and the sound will instantly jump anywhere
to that spot. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
And it's just an amazing piece of equipment, and it's going to take quite a while to learn all the ins and outs of it. But the fact that, you know, the mix we're doing now is about 200 tracks wide, and I have 48 faders, but I can, in real time... spin a wheel and shuffle the whole console from left to right so that all 200 tracks can slide back and forth in front of you. It's I'm not sure I'm describing that right.
One thing that's great about the Icon is that there's something similar to what's on Euphonics called spill tracks. So if you can have one fader, let's say, represent a string section, that's one fader. You hit the fader, and it'll spill out to the rest of the 48 faders all the components of that string.
Wow.
So before it used to be with Digi where fader 1 was track 1, right, fader right, 2 was track right. 2. Now it'll almost do a matrixing of tracks where you can organize it however you want. And then if you want to spill out the details and get into the nuances of what makes up that fader, that group fader, you can do that as well.
They call them custom faders.
Right.
And they're accompanied by a lovely little blue LED.
Wow.
And, you can basically assign parts of the console to be whatever you want. So it can be tracks that spill out to other faders when you press them, or you can put all the parameters from your plugins onto faders, or all the parameters from a virtual instrument onto the faders. It's really configurable. And you also, with the icon, have snapshots. So you can do very, very complex snapshots for a scene in a film or for part of a song, whatever, and then apply that snapshot to other parts of the project. And you can name the snapshots, and you have basically dedicated buttons for everything you can think of. The thing has thousands of buttons and lights on it.
Let me ask you this, Rob. Is there actually EQ on it, or is it just purely a surface?
No, it's purely a control surface. Mm-hmm. The only analog audio on the thing is a talkback mic and a listen-back mic and a monitor section. It does have a 7-1 pretty sophisticated monitor matrix built into it, but it is there's no audio that actually passes through it. When we ripped out the O2Rs, to get up and running with the icon once it was physically installed, which took a little while, was basically one Ethernet cable coming out of a hub and going back to the back room where my Ethernet switch was. It was one cable to get the whole thing up and running. When you're sitting in front of it, though, it does have dedicated knobs and buttons for an EQ section and for dynamics. And every fader strip has, I think, six knobs on it, which can be assigned to EQ or aux sends or plug-in parameters. You forget that you're just sitting in front of a control surface and that there's no audio going through it. It feels like a large format analog console when you're using it.
Now, let me ask you, okay, what was the worst thing about your installation? What was the hardest thing about
writing the check?
What's the one thing that surprised you? You know, I don't want to say that you hated, but what's the one thing that's what was the negative? If you give the positive, what's the negative?
The negative? I think it's, I mean, in all seriousness, I think it's a bit expensive for what it is. I mean, there's not really any competition. Digi has kind of made sure that no one else is going to get that protocol anytime soon. And I did look at the Euphonics control surfaces and some others, which all basically have to emulate Huey's because that's the last protocol that Digi released to the universe. So I think that the both the D-Control, which is the big one, and the D-Command, right, which is the little one, I think they're both slightly overpriced for what they are, but I think they're both great, and there's no competition. So,
well, yeah, I mean,
that's
I
how
work
they get
on,
away with it.
I work on the D command and then the and it's a cool little mixer.
It's very surface, cool, but I don't know if it's cool for the price.
One thing I saw that the Euphonics had that was kind of neat, the little controller, is a the whole channel strip would be color coded based on whatever type of plug-in you in. Like EQs were all blue and compressors were green and. So when you looked across the console at any time, you knew what a knob was assigned to at any given point, rather than like, oh, I just turned a compressor and I thought it was on the EQ plugin. And
well, I will say the labeling on the D control is pretty comprehensive. It's pretty easy to know where you are.
And there's a lot of color coding, though. I went over to see this the other night at Rob's, and we're just noticing some of the color coding that had happened on the displays. And unfortunately, Rob's slightly colorblind and couldn't actually tell. So yeah. Green and orange for Rob, it's the same shade of brown, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I'm actually having a little bit of a hard time getting used to that.
There's color modes.
Because there's a huge amount of color coding on the D control as well, which is cool.
It's actually laid out very, very logically.
Right.
I don't really, at this point, I don't have really much bad to say about it. I went into the purchase definitely with my eyes open. I had spent a lot of time being demoed on it. I will say it's different when you see someone who knows how to use it. Tom Graham is a great demo guy, and I sat and watched him use the thing for quite a while. Everything looks incredibly easy. Now I'm sitting at home with the thing, and I'm saying, okay, now I know Tom reached over here, and there was a button that did this really cool thing, and I just sit there, and my eyes start to cross after a while, because there's so many buttons.
Now, do you find yourself looking at the screen less now that you have the
command? Not yet. You know what? This thing is really new, and I'm right in the middle of a film mix, right, which I thought was going to be over by now, which is why I scheduled to get the new console. But the film mix is taking longer than we planned, and we still have about another week to go, but I had to get the new console in for some other projects that are lined up for afterwards. So for right now, I'm not nearly taking full advantage of the board. I'm still using the screen and the mouse a lot. And, I mean, that's going to have to change, but it's not going to change much till after this film.
And the transport.
No,
stop.
I'm not using the I'm using the space bar. I will say I have been, as of today, I found myself using the panner a huge amount, though, because it's so easy to – something I never used to do in Pro Tools, which is so easy with the D control, is to think of the automation as sort of clip-based or scene-based, where you can have not presets, really, but snapshots that you can reapply to other parts of your project. And I never used to think of working in Pro Tools that way. And that's one of the things about the icon that has definitely already saved me time just in the couple days I've had it.
Andrew, have you ever been the resident mixer here? Have you ever mixed on an icon?
No. No. I had a Pro Control for I still have it. And but no. And now I've got the big old Neve thing. Right. So
but you still have to come over and mix something at my house just so I can watch you and learn something.
Well, once I learn it.
It'll be interesting to see.
I mean, I've seen some of the feature set would be great. Because, I mean, when I mix with my Pro Control and I was still mixing in Pro Tools, it was all about just having faders because I can't stand writing things with the mouse because I don't want to look at it. I don't want to know. I just want to move physical faders. And you get the feeling that I would get from faders from everything on the D control because it is all there on nice knobs, or you can spill it onto faders. And I mean, we were doing things with a compressor plugin where you take any parameters you want and just chuck them on faders. So let's say if you want to ride the compression because you're matching takes and things like that, you can actually just put it on a fader and you get used to the feel
really
of it.
It's really easy to do that.
No, that's cool.
So I'm sure I'll actually like it a lot.
Yeah, well, you know what? Do some mixing over at Rob's studio and then come
back.
And
we'll report back. I will say another thing that we were looking at the other night that's really cool about it is each fader has a meter, actually 2 meters with it, and you can put the D control in one mode where if you're using any kind of gain reduction, like a compressor or a limiter or whatever, the left meter on each strip is your level meter, and the right meter shows you gain reduction.
Wow.
So top down, the more you compress it, right, fills the meter up. It's great.
And
old school.
You know, I was not really sure how many faders I wanted to get with this thing. The basic system is 16 faders, but there are a lot of 32 fader systems out there. And I understand why, because 32 is actually a really usable number. The reason I got 48 is I wanted to have 16 faders that could be sort of those custom faders,
right,
for specialty things or for group masters or whatever. And then I was thinking, you know, a typical group that we would have would be drums and percussion. And I just know, if I had a 32 fader unit, the drums and percussion would always be like 17 channels or 18 channels, and we wouldn't be able to have them all up at once. And while I like a virtual control surface and I like being able to address more tracks than I have physical faders for, within a group of sounds, I don't want to have to be doing bank switching. So if I'm going to have the drums and percussion up, I want to be able to have all of them up at once. I don't want to have to go between pages of drums because I know that would drive me nuts. So by having 48 faders, I can have 16 dedicated to special functions, but then 32 that are purely, you know, basically musical instruments most of the time.
Wow.
I mean, we'll see if I'm right, but it seems like a good idea at the
all
time.
Right. Well, guys, we're going to have to wrap it up.
Wait.
But before we go.
Forget again.
No, I wasn't going to forget you.
Okay.
No, good fake, Mike.
He already had forgotten. But we remember.
No. But before we go, Scott, you said you wanted to make an announcement.
Llamas Anonymous. No, sorry. I just had to go there. Actually, it is quite exciting. Next week is the Computer Game Developers Conference up in San Francisco. And I am launching a brand new organization called the IESD, Interactive Entertainment Sound Developers. And it is a pro audio organization similar to AES. It's actually it's a branch of GANG, which is a Game Audio Network Guild. We have all these like acronyms. And what's great is I've got three other partners in this with me. I've got Dave Morant from Sony and Scott Selfon from Microsoft and Gene Simmel from High Moon. And what's great is it's going to be an international organization. We've gotten Dolby to come on and SC Electronics has come on. Sponsors are coming out of the woodworks. We pretty much figure we're going to probably have at least 500 members within GDC itself. It's exciting and it's something new because what it's doing is it's not just dealing with video games, it's dealing with computer entertainment. and this is a organization committee dedicated to increasing audio technologies, standardizations, yada, yada, yada. And anyway, so it launches next Thursday in San Francisco.
Is there a website that people can go to if they wanted to check it out or become a member? Or?
Yeah, it's Game Audio Network Guild is the actual parent organization. And I think it's gang.org or something to that effect. Game Audio, something like that. And the difference with ISD is students are not allowed in it. You've got to be at least 1 year and have completed one video game to be in it. And then for credits, you can use the ISD moniker at the end of your name, similar to MPSC and CAS and many of those other situations. But what's great is we've put together an advisory committee where we've got representatives of every major studio in the industry. And with new technologies, what's called Next Gen, which is PS3 and Xbox 360, we have the ability now for audio to make a difference and to take it to another level. And, you know, right now, the people that are getting involved with games is a lot of the major film people, the composers, all the major directors in film are now starting to do video games. It's a new technology. It's a whole new industry that's starting to mature from being a baby to now having some depth. And we, in this organization want to, create the beginnings of that and get the brain trust together and help propel that industry.
Wow, it sounds like a really great organization that's really going to fulfill a need for, a lot of the sound designers out there that work on video games and the next generation consoles. All right, guys. Well, hey, let's just wrap it up. And before we go, anybody else have anything they want to say? Anybody working on anything cool that you can talk about?
Nope.
Is that no or is that no?
That we'll find out. soon.
Andrew, I hope you enjoy your red carpet.
Thank you. I will. I'm going to dress up and stand on it.
And Martin, I know you're still working. You're moving into the next level of.
Yeah, well, we're pushing it. You know, the new record should be. I said it should be out this month, but it's probably going to be in the next couple of months because all the little things that you think are going to happen fast slow down a little bit. But we've got the website on myspace.com, so just starting up, and another professional site. We're doing that as well, and we're doing the artwork now for the album. And you're going to help me with some visuals for some documentary stuff. So. At the moment, the website on MySpace is getting everybody interested, and I hope to be in the next 2 months to get this out. But there's a lot of preparation, more than I thought, but it's going well, and I'm enjoying it still.
And I just want to tell people that I had the privilege of being able to hear a couple of the tracks that are coming out, and it's awesome. It really, it's really good.
Thank you, Mike.
And I'm not just saying that just to, you know, give you a big head or anything, but it's really good. So it's going to be exciting. And, you know, we're going to report more on the developments because Martin is going to be moving into, you know, another phase as far as the self-promotion with doing some EPK stuff and some stuff on the web. And it'll be really interesting to hear.
It is fun because it's the first time I've done this independently. So it's good to share it.
Because
this is my own label. So there's been a lot of learning going on. So maybe I can pass some of that hell information on to people.
Especially with the press and dealing with radio stations and things like that all on your own, stuff that your label used to do, and now you're doing it on yourself.
Exactly.
All right. Well, one last thing is I just want to introduce my brother who's here visiting us. His name is Ben. And he's been back there behind me poking me all the time. But no,
he's been making faces behind you. I know that.
But yes, so thanks for sitting in and, you know. Tell Mom and Dad that I did a good job. Okay?
And what about our engineer?
And April, who's doing our engineering, also producing the show. And so from all the guys at the Audio Nowcast, we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye. DMP7's coming soon.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio.
The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.